All right, Genesis chapter 4. Thank you, Joe, for helping me through my coronary a minute ago when I was up, got in here, plugged in. I accidentally deleted my entire Genesis folder and couldn't find it. He helped me do that. So we're back on track. In our study of Genesis and us, and as we begin to look at Genesis chapter 4, we're going to read chapter 4 in just a moment. And there's 26 verses there. We'll take turns reading that like we traditionally have been doing. So let's get our Bibles out and let's turn to Genesis chapter 4, and I'll read the first three verses, and if we'll just go around quickly, we'll read all three and just we'll have the text before us. Genesis chapter 4. Now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain, and she said, I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. Again, she gave birth to his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground.
And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof, and the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, Why art thou wroth, and why is thy countenance fallen?
If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Cain spoke to Abel his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, Where is Abel your brother? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?
And he said, What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you shall be on the earth. And Cain said to the Lord, My punishment is greater than I can bear. Surely you have driven me out this day from the face of the ground. I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. And it will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me. And the Lord said to him, Therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him.
And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived, and bare Enoch, and he built a city, and called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. And unto Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begat Mahujael, and Mahujael begat Methuselah, and Methuselah begat Lamech.
Then Lamech took for himself two wives. The name of one was Adah, and the name of the second was Zillah. And Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the harp and flute.
And Zillah, she also bare Sibylcain, an instructor of every artificer of brass and iron, and the sister of Sibylcain was Naamah. And Lamech said unto his wives, Ada and Zillah, Hear my voice, ye wives of Lamech. Hearken unto my speech, for I have slain a man to my wounding, and a young man to my hurt. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold.
Okay, I'll finish up verse 25. Adam had relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth. For, she said, God has appointed me another offspring in place of Abel, for Cain killed him. To Seth, to him also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. It's an interesting chapter. Thank you for taking time to read that with us. And I want to go back to a theme that we've seen already in this book. And that theme is this idea of the socialness and the relationship that God intends to have with man and God intends for man to have with man. And we see right here at the beginning of chapter 4, we're hit with the furthering explanation. It's one thing to say, yes, I understand relationships and friendships and fellowships and associations man to man and so forth, but what does that mean? How does God define what that should look like? And here in the beginning of chapter 4, we're hit with this in that we're told of our responsibility toward each other. We're not our brother's father. We're not his brother's father, or we're not his keeper. We are our brother's brother. And God puts great emphasis on that, doesn't he? With the story that we read, just got through reading. And did you notice how God now has moved the conversation about relationships with him from the question he asked Adam in the garden after he had sinned with Eve? What was his question that God, the first question God asked Adam when he came to the garden? Where are you, Adam? Where are you? And so he's moved from where are you to this profound development of where is your brother? You see the difference in the question that Cain got versus his father Adam got? Where are you? That's a direct relationship. It's addressing the relationship between God and him, of Adam. Now God is addressing this relationship that Cain has violated with his brother. And so there's great emphasis put on that. Why is that important? For both audiences for this book, both Israel at Sinai as well as all mankind. Why is that question important?
Second greatest commandment, to love our neighbor as ourselves.
Yes, exactly. Love your neighbor as yourself. How do you understand what that means if you don't have the right understanding of the concept that God intends for man in relationship to have with other man? And so this is a very important chapter for us to get those concepts in place in front of us. If man was not meant to be alone, and if he was not made to be alone, naturally associations will occur. Isolation wasn't part of God's plan, was it? But here, because of Cain's sin against Abel, isolation is, in fact, imposed upon Cain, isn't it? He's driven out now from his immediate family, from his parents, and it says he has a mark placed upon him in order to protect him in relationship so that vengeance would not be taken upon him. And then Moses inserts in the text here the immediate genealogy of Cain to show that he went on to participate in mankind's development upon the earth. But if we're careless of the brother, of our brother, we're careless of ourselves. Because God expects us as social creatures to have these relationships, and if we don't protect those relationships, in essence, we're really not protecting ourselves. Because it's something God has instilled in us from the very beginning. To be responsible before God is to be responsible for your brother. Did you notice as we read through this in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 9, the Lord asked Cain this question, "Where is Abel your brother?" And he said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Do you hear the disdain in the way that that text reads? Who is Cain speaking to? He is speaking to Yahweh, his creator. And yet he seems to have total disdain to the challenge as well as the responsibility for his brother, and for Abel. He wants nothing to do with Abel. He rejects that. And by rejecting that, he's rejecting the relationship that he would have with God. And so he's pushing back at that. And so in verse 12, when his pronouncement of judgment is placed upon him, what in verse 13 does Cain then say back to Yahweh? Oh, my punishment is too great. You're isolating me. You're putting something upon me that I cannot bear. But why is it so hard to bear? Look at the end of verse 14. What's Cain concerned about? That somebody's going to kill him. Well, isn't that what you just did to Abel? Would that not be justice? Do we not see that very principle later on put in place of in the Mosaic Law? You know, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, and those principle. And yet, Cain is concerned that he will receive justice for what he has done. And so the Lord marks him so that he would be appointed to him a sign so that anyone finding him would not slay him. It would be a violation of God's law to do so. And so he is pleading for God for fairness and relief from the very thing and for fear of the very thing that he had already done with Abel. Now also, do you see the disdain that he has for Abel and the offering that Abel offered? What did Abel offer the Lord? Yeah, sacrifice, right? An animal sacrifice. What did Cain offer? Sacrifice of what?
Food from the ground.
Yeah, food from the ground. And it...
He made a deal and traded with his brother. Couldn't he have given his brother...
Well, certainly he could have and should have, because... It's clear indication to me in this text and others that God does not require anything of man that he does not allow man to be able to fulfill. Cain understood what would be acceptable to the Lord, and he chose not to do it. Abel understood what was acceptable to the Lord also, and did do it. And so when Cain did what he did in the slaying, he was jealous of Abel. And again, we mentioned this last week in just the preface at the very close of class. Do you remember what Abel's occupation was? A tender of flocks, right? And Cain was a tiller of the ground. And what was Adam? He was a gardener. He was a farmer. He was a tender of the ground. What were they eating up until the time of the flood, by all indication? Were they eating animals? No. Of every plant on earth and everything God created, he said, I've given unto you for food. Okay? That did not include animals. And so there is indication that until the flood, man did not eat meat. And so the sacrifice that Abel was giving and others to God was holy and dedicated unto them. It wasn't a common thing for them to participate in. It was for that purpose. But the insolence that Cain displays here is something that we need to recognize. He's despising his shepherd brother who kept sheep, and this leads him to derisively ask if he's expected really to be, am I to be the shepherd's shepherd, in essence? And when you think about Israel now at Sinai receiving this message, think of the insolence that you see among Israel and the way that it's put forward in much of the rest of the Mosaical books. What were they known for all through the wilderness wanderings as they interacted with Moses and the Lord? It's not complaining. Is not insolence a good word to kind of generalize the way they revered or looked at the Lord? They were constantly questioning and bickering and murmuring and wishing they were still back in Egypt and so forth and had not been relieved of that. So this insolence is the sin that Cain allowed to drive a wedge between mankind and his creator. It drove a wedge between sin, drove a wedge between husband and wife, and now it's created a rift between brother and brother. And again, why is this such a critical principle for the Israelites to understand? What is God intend for them to do and be? To be His? Okay. What's their mission as a nation? Well, as a people, a group of people, a group of family tribes, to become a nation. And what were they to do as a nation?
They were to be the example to all nations.
Yeah, that's an interesting, yeah, that's a good point. That's true. I was thinking about the conquest of the land. They were to go to and receive the promise that Abraham had been given to receive the land of Canaan, and within it to establish a nation that would follow Jehovah. And so this idea of brothers fighting brothers, does that work within a nation? It destroys nations, doesn't it? We nearly had one in this country a few hundred years ago, 165, 75 years ago, right? We had a civil war. 360,000 men died to address those issues and to save the Union. Right? And so, no small thing there, is it? Tremendously important for Israel to understand. And later on, what are we going to see is one of the large problems that happens in Israel. Rage and jealousy does, in fact, rise itself and creates issues for them to have to deal with. But rage and jealousy blinds us to this idea, this concept of brotherhood. It gets in the way of that. It prevents us from seeing that. God didn't just create creatures. He created sons. And if we're sons and daughters of the same Creator, what does that mean for us? We have relationship, don't we? We're brothers and sisters. And that means something to God. He has always intended it to mean something. Luke 3, verse 38 calls us all sons. And if we're all sons, then we're all brothers. All right, let's look very quickly over it. Somebody turn over to Matthew chapter 25 and verse 34. Let's read 34 through the end of the chapter. I know it's kind of a lengthy reading, but this is an important concept that Jesus is addressing here, is this same issue of mankind fellowship and relationship. It's exactly what God was dealing with and was trying to impress upon Cain. All right? Joe, you got that? Starting verse 34, Matthew 25.
Then the king will say to those on his right hand, "Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me a drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothed you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?" And the king will answer and say to them, "Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me." Then he will also say to those on the left hand, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me." Then they also will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them, saying, assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life.
How bold is this statement that Jesus is presenting here in Matthew chapter 25 to mankind? How bold is that? What's Jesus really asking or teaching us here? What would the response of these people when they're challenged by the Lord in this? He's really asking them, do you see me or recognize me when you look at your needy fellow man, mankind? These are no special people that the Lord enters into that story and into that lesson he's teaching, is it? He didn't say, when you saw your cousin or your brother or your sister in jail, or when they were hungry, you fed them or you didn't feed them, or any other kin or relationships. What's the determining factor here? They're human and they're in need. And do you see me, Jesus Christ, when you see them in that need? That puts it on some pretty bold footing for us, doesn't it? Because what do? I'm guilty. You don't have to look any further than just about every intersection in town. And before you jump into, well, they're just a bunch of drug addicts and they're homeless because they are just that way, let's just put that aside for just a moment and think. They're human and they're in need. Now, how do we address that? What did Jesus say? Do you see Jesus Christ when you look at them? That's the mindset of what our response to those people should be based upon. So we have to look at these situations and say, when I see needy people, I have to start from a basis of I'm seeing Jesus in this. I see Jesus in their need. You know, there was a popular phrase a number of years ago of, you know, what would Jesus do? That's, you know, I'm not taking you there in that sense, but that's exactly a basis or a starting point for us to enter into the decision makings we take at that point. So before we act like Levites and priests and pass along the other side of the wounded man on the side of the road, we need to think about the primacy of the attitude of the Good Samaritan, right? And again, that's just another illustration of how the Lord taught this idea of primacy of relationships of man to man. Cain was the first one to violate that, but he by no means was the last. And it's a problem throughout history, and it's a challenge for us. And the Lord puts it to us in very strong terms there in Matthew 25. Luke 16 talks to us about, again by the Lord, about the rich man and Lazarus. Did the rich man see the Lord when he saw Lazarus sitting at his doorstep or every day as he walked past Lazarus who was begging? And then the rich man dies, Lazarus dies and receives a blessing and is it received into Abraham's bosom, but the rich man is what? He's in torment. And so again, this principle is at play in within that illustration. But so it's abundantly clear here in Genesis 4 that God's will for mankind is for us to live in loving fellowship with one another. It's a very strong principle here. 1 John, I won't take time to read this, but 1 John 3, verses 13 through well into chapter 4, almost all of chapter 4 in 1 John. Again, John talks about the loving of your fellow man as well. And that's a tremendous passage to maybe put in your margin of your notes for this Genesis chapter 4. Okay. Cain was a really bad man, wasn't he? He was. Cain was really bad. And no doubt in the end, there's no excuse for what he did. He had to be dealt with in the way that God dealt with him. God is righteous, and he's a just God. We see this best exposed to us when we get to Genesis chapter 18. We'll see how God clearly defines and demonstrates that. But Cain wasn't always bad. There was a day when God saw him ill-tempered, right? And jealous of Abel, because Abel's sacrifice was received and his own was rejected. But he hadn't acted upon it yet. And so what did God do at that point with Cain? Did he just write him off? He came to him, didn't he? And what did he, what would you say would be the tone of the conversation between the Lord and Cain at that point? What was God's point of having that conversation?
It was like the father reasoning with his son.
You know, the Lord is really good at asking questions, isn't it? When you see the Lord asking questions, the Lord doesn't ask questions because he doesn't know something. He's asking questions to bring the person to a point of understanding something. And so he asked Cain what? Yeah. Why are you so angry? What has you so angry? Your offering wasn't rejected out of spite or partiality by me. Okay, that tells us a lot about the awareness of Cain knew what would please the Lord, and he intentionally chose not to do it. He seems to say to Cain here, if you do what is right, you know that I will accept you. Doesn't this sound kind of like the older brother in Luke 15, the parable of the prodigal son? Remember that story? In the parable of the prodigal son, the younger son is the one who took his share of the inheritance and went and lived a riotous life and lost it all. But what did the older son do? Stayed home, stayed with his father, did basically what a good son would do. And then the prodigal son comes back. And now, what is the attitude of the elder son to the returning son? His brother, okay? Don't miss that point. His brother returns. And what's his attitude toward his brother? He's angry. You know, all these years I've served you, and not one time have you done for me and my friends what you're doing for him. Much the same situation as what Cain was sitting in at that point with that conversation with the Lord. And so what is the Lord doing here? He is encouraging Cain to be a man, to step up and do what is right, and you know I will accept you. He knows Cain is in this life and death struggle, but he also knows that Cain could win that fight. And he urges him to win it. He comes to Cain at that crucial moment, knowing how crucial it is for the sinning man. He tries to rally him for the fight of his life. And I look at that and I go, don't you just love that about God? That he sees you in these situations, he sees me in these situations, and he will come to you, and he comes to me. And, you know, that's when I just plow right through the hedges, you know. That's when I hit that speed bump and just step on the gas. I don't listen to God. I just go and sin. I do what I shouldn't do. But rare is the time that I don't have that bump, because I can see it in hindsight, you know, feel it. Once I've hit the consequences of the sin, I go, I didn't listen. He gave me an opportunity to avoid that. He gave me an out. I didn't take that exit. I just kept driving down the wrong road. But I love that about God. Would you want God cheering you on to do what's right? Absolutely. And he is, and he does. And that's what he was doing for Cain here. And Cain would not listen. Cain didn't make it. But it wasn't because God didn't urge him in every way to win. And I think that's an important point in Genesis 4 for us to consider as well. Okay.
Martin, I've got to ask or say, I've not seen this in this passage ever. I've seen God taking a person who sinned to task for what he did.
Well, he hadn't done anything.
Seen encouragement, like, son, do better, you'll be fine. He's taking him to task. He's pointing out what he's done wrong. And all it does in Cain, and I'm not saying this is God's fault, but all it does with Cain is just make him madder. I see the older brother being mad because he has to go to his younger brother for a lamb. He doesn't like that.
Okay.
For whatever reason, who knows? You know, and apparently it says Cain talked with Abel in the field, so Cain initiated the conversation, and as they talked, he just got madder and madder until he flew off the handle and killed his brother. Now he's got the first murder. And I've never been particularly clear as to why God did not see fit to kill him. This to me seems to be one of those drop the hammer kind of moments.
But at the time in verse 5 and 6, when the Lord is speaking to Cain, Cain has not sinned. He hasn't sinned yet. He's angry. He says he's very angry and his countenance has fell.
His
countenance has fallen.
No, but his
and he hasn't killed Abel.
Not a sin?
Well, I'm talking about in his relationship and what he's about to do. Okay? Yeah, clearly he has sinned in the sense of he did not follow the commandment to do what he should have done in the sacrifice, yes. But I'm saying he has not sinned yet in his violation of this relationship with his brother, his fellow man, and the value that God places upon that. And let me see if I can find a parallel for this here. I got a side note here in verse 3:16. Well, that's not a... I don't understand that one. But anyway, look at the last part of verse 7. He says, and if you do what is well, or if you do not do well, sin is couching at the door. So in other words, sin has not entered the house of Cain yet in regarding of Abel and this anger that he's trying to deal with. And its desire is for you. But he says, but you, Cain, you must master it. He has to master this anger and this countenance that's fallen before he acts with it. You have to control this emotion that you're feeling. And Cain, obviously, in verse 8, does not. He loses this fight against his controlling of anger. And he does something that obviously is horrendous. That's where I see that. That's the way I understand it. I don't think it's any different than what really you're saying. Like I said before, Cain was not a good man. But he wasn't bad all the time, constantly. At least the Lord saw redemptive value in him. Otherwise, he wouldn't even bother talking to him. Right? He went to him. And that's the point I'm trying to make, is we have a God that will come to sinning men and seek to lead you in the right way. Larry?
One of the characteristics of anger when it is not controlled is that it shuts down the mind. And you see here, I believe, an appeal of God to try to get him to think. This reminds me of when Jesus was trying to talk to Peter that Satan's going to sift you as wheat. You know, when, pray that your faith will not fail, and he just ignored it and went on into, denying the Lord. But here the nature of anger is so powerful. He already had a problem, and he was being asked about it, and then he pointed out that this can be your master. This can become your master. Sin's desires for you, I think it's the did. And once he made that turn, he could kill his brother. And then talk to Almighty God and lie to his face and think he could get away with it. And he just became the center of his own universe. And you begin to see later in his descendants where I guess he was bad boy and there are others saying, yeah, I was worse than him and boast about it. It's quite interesting to see the progression.
Well, it goes to the point that kind of the, chapter 4 ends with, because at the end of, how does the chapter end? Let's look at the end of chapter 4. What's the last sentence in chapter 4? Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. This is not an, for Cain it was an issue of anger that caused the sin, but reality is there men, this development is in relationships. Man gives you a choice. You can be a son of God and one of the righteous, or you can be a son of Satan and be one of the unrighteous. And this development in the history of mankind, Moses is putting it out here. Again, think about Israel. They're sitting at Sinai. What are they getting ready to have happen to them? When they leave Sinai, they're going to go in and try to conquer the land. And they can have two attitudes about this. They can have the attitude of Joshua, okay, who looked toward the Lord as his deliverer and his means of help in all things. We can do all things with God's help. Caleb and Joshua's reply after spying out the land. Or you can have the other response and be one of the murmurers and be one of the followers of Korah, and you can be what the rest of Israel represented, and they get represented here in type, at least, by Cain and his descendants, because they've chosen to be sons of men and not sons of God. And there's this development of an understanding that there is developing a difference in people. Some are going to choose to follow God, and some are not. And it begins here in Genesis chapter 4. Okay? And so this division of righteous seekers and non-seekers is identified really here for the first time, all right? And we'll see this demonstrated again with Israel after Sinai, and we'll also see it with when the gospel comes in Acts chapter 2. All through Acts, it's really that same decision point, right? I'm going to follow God, I'm going to reject the gospel. I'm going to obey the gospel, I'm going to reject the gospel. And so I think that's a point we can learn from that too, but the point I was trying to make with this is we have a God who is an encourager of good. And he wants us to obey and be righteous. And he will do what he can to help us. All right. Anything else from chapter 4 before we go into chapter 5? We got a few minutes.
Yes, I think I tried to bring it out, but what Lamech said, you know, Cain says, my punishment is too much. Now Lamech says, man, I want mine to be greater than, you know, just the arrogance. I want mine to be greater.
Yeah, he's not murdered once, but he's murdered twice, right?
Yeah, and he says, if Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77.
And he's setting his own parole, isn't he?
That he's now boasting about rebellion against God. That's the thing. It's now, it's his glory.
So where can we kind of summarize, and this is really a summarization by Moses of Cain and Canaan's descendants here. Where are Cain and Canaan's descendants going in their relationship with God? Away. Further and further away. The world is being populated by descendants of Cain who are moving away from God, not having anything to do with him. All right? And so now we see that kind of set up in 4, and then we enter 5. Now, we're not going to take time to read Genesis 5. There's a lot of names here. Okay, it's a genealogy of the descendants of Adam. But when we read through Genesis 5, I think there's some important things we need to notice. And one of the things is in chapter 5 and verse 2, it says, he made him, he created them, he blessed them. You see that? What a great summary of the first three chapters in Genesis of what God did for man. He created him, then he created, or made him, created them, male and female, and then he's blessed them. Okay? And he's blessing them with children. And yet, we read in this chapter, even though he has blessed them, what's the phrase that you read over and over again in this chapter? And he died. They lived a long time. It lists all the years they lived. But ultimately, how does every character in this chapter end? And he died. And he died. And he died. And he died. Now, what did God say was going to happen when they left the garden because of their sin? From the dust of the ground you were formed, and what? And to the dust of the ground you will return, or that's where you'll go. So, God is faithful, but we see in this that no matter who it was, ultimately, and he died. Now, we have one character here that there is an exception in verse 21, isn't there? What's the exception? Who's the exception? Enoch, right? It doesn't say that he died, does it? What does it say? Enoch did what? Yeah, verse 21, 22, he walked with God. Verse 24, he walked with God and he was not, for he died? No, he was not, because what? For God took him. For God took him. So, that is an interesting point in 5. So, why is that listed, and what lesson can we pull out of this genealogy concerning Enoch? He walked with God. And one day, perhaps the way we could look at it is, they walked together so far from Enoch's home that God just said, why don't you just come on home with me? It's a lot closer. So he went on home with God to dwell with him. Now, I don't know if that's a good way to look at that or not, but it clearly says that Enoch walked with God. And that expression to me just means it's devotion at its finest. And was it a one-day walk? How old was Enoch? 300 years, right? Verse 21. He lived 65 years before he became the father of Methuselah. Then he walked with God 300 years. Okay. That's a long walk with God, isn't it? This wasn't a one-day emotional event for Enoch. He walked with God for 300 years. Speaks of the longevity of that relationship, doesn't it, with his sovereign God? It speaks more than just the created and the creator. There was a relationship of father and son there, Jehovah and Enoch, friend and friend, 300 years. So I think it's important to, when we see Enoch, to think permanency. God wants a permanent good relationship with us, not just one based on an emotional moment that would be here one day and gone the next, but one that is lasting. It's easy to maintain a godly relationship in the moments of emotional fervor, but the test truly comes in when? When it's lifelong dedication. Enoch tells us that reconciliation with God, walking with God, is what brings you victory over death. Did he have victory over death? How did he receive it? He walked with God. Is that not what Jesus Christ offers us through the gospel? Enoch was the seventh from Adam, and he did not die. Noah is an interesting character. He's mentioned in verse 32. He is listed here, and we're going to see that the story now is going to shift to our first major character past Adam in the character of Noah. And so we will look at Noah the next several chapters, and the story that we see of Noah is actually is pretty concise within Genesis. You know, by the time we get to chapter 10, 6 through 10, we're finished with Noah. That's the entire story. But he's listed as a descendant of Adam. And what does it say? You know, the last part of chapter 4, then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Enoch is listed as having walked with God. And now we're going to see similar things said concerning Noah. He was a good man. He was 500 years old. Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. He began to beget children. Okay. Any other comments or questions about chapter 5? A couple of references for Enoch walk with God that I would give you if you want a better explanation of what does it mean to walk with God. Micah 6 and verse 8 is a good passage to put in your margin for that. And also 1 John 1 and verse 7. Are two good side references for this idea of walking with God and what's required in that. Micah, especially 6:8, has a lovely passage that explains that.
It seems interesting to me, having noted the arrogance of Lamech in chapter 4, that he begets Noah, and Noah is going to be quite different.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That is quite interesting.
Well, no, this isn't the same Lamech that's over here in chapter 4. And that's the confusing thing. And on some of these genealogies, these names are very similar, if not the same. We have a Lamech who's the son of Cain, or a descendant of Cain. And then you have Lamech who is the descendant of Seth. Okay? And so Noah is the descendant of Lamech. But I will say, what is interesting here is, when did Methuselah die? And when did Lamech die? More than likely, they died in the flood. If you do the math, right? And so you look at that and you go, they didn't get on the boat. Methuselah and Lamech didn't get on the boat. Noah saved how many souls? In 100 years of preaching while he was building the ark, he had seven people get on the boat with him. And his father and his grandfather were not two of them. Now, did they drown in the flood, or did God cause them to die the year of the flood? We don't know. But they didn't survive the flood, put it that way. So it's an interesting thing here that we'll be looking at. And chapter 6 begins, y'all, with an interesting passage, the first few verses. And I have an overall understanding, I guess, maybe a high level of the Nephilim and all of that. We'll talk through that as I understand it next week. And then we move on into the story of Noah. Okay.
Just a note that this small commentary on Enoch is a glimpse of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got this chapter 3, we talk about
Yep. And so I will say, along that same line, since you mentioned something else about Enoch, for the nation of Israel to hear this story and to read or to listen to Genesis chapter 5, who do they get to relate to in Genesis chapter 5? And he died, and he died, and he died, and he died. What's going to happen to the nation of Israel and every single individual who left Egypt out of bondage, led out by the mighty hand of God to Sinai to receive this word? What's going to happen to every single one of them except two? They're going to die. They're going to die. They're going to die. They're going to die. There's going to be at least 1 million Israelites die in the wilderness wandering. Probably closer to 2 million. They're going to die. And this passage is telling them exactly what's going to happen, because they're some of mankind. Now, who gets to relate to Enoch in the story of the Israelites? Joshua and Caleb. Because they did not die. They got to enter into the land. And what is it said about them? They were righteous. They were godly men. They walked with God. in what we see among them and in their mind, right? It's an interesting analogy of types there. If you want to call Enoch a type, he's a type for Joshua and Caleb. And the rest of the list in the genealogy of Seth are a type for what's going to happen to the children of Israel in the wandering.
Maybe I've been looking at chapter 5 the wrong way all these years. Based on what you're saying about God's intent to our generation and to the Israelites, or I mean Moses, to write this as he did, was to get them to understand that they had a responsibility to each other. What we see here then are many generations of people who did not live that way. Oh, they made babies that weren't godly people, and they made babies that weren't godly people. And apparently only Enoch was one that emerged as a godly man.
Mm-hmm.
And Noah, of course. Is that...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we could label or straddle these other individuals listed as descendants of Seth here as wicked, but they're not listed anywhere that I'm aware of, any of them, as being godly righteous other than Noah and Enoch. So, well, I'm not trying to be relative here of, well, you can be a little bad or you can be like Cain and be a lot bad. And bad is bad, right? But I go back to the end of chapter 4. It says, and men began to call upon the name of the Lord. There were some. Where did Noah's righteousness come from? Where did his awareness of Yahweh come from? Right? I mean, he didn't get it from Adam. They didn't see, Noah never knew Adam, if you do the math. But he might have known Enoch. I forget if they actually overlapped a little bit or not. But
could that phrase, the way that men began to call him the name of the Lord, be a reference to in general?
Yeah, I think
widespread. Not that they never did before.
Yeah, the worship of the Lord began. Recognition of him as the Creator began among men. There were always, some righteous, and there will be some that would be unrighteous. But by the time we get to 6, that worship has deteriorated and gone astray to the point that it says that the wickedness on the face of the earth was great, and the Lord looked upon it, and it was so bad, he decided to destroy the earth. And that's where we really will pick up next week with Genesis chapter 6. All right, time really went by fast tonight. I hope it's helpful to kind of maybe take a little different approach to some of this. Just trying to make sure that we're gleaning from this the best of what we can glean. Many of us have studied these chapters a lot and just trying to hit some points that maybe we haven't really thought through that would be of especially meaningful for the Israelites to understand and to take from it what Moses would want them to take from it, as well as the larger audience, which would include us today. Okay. Joe, would you knock on their doors there, and we'll call class dismissed for tonight. We've had a wonderful visit this week with our visitor from